Good afternoon. You're listening to Around the Block, a community news program from the Block by Block team at WPBM LP 106.5 FM. On the show, we'll explore issues in the Philadelphia region with voices from the community through original reports from our team of journalists and live interviews. I'm Crystal Herrera.
And I'm Sultan Smalley. Coming up, we'll be speaking with Pennsylvania State Representative Chris Rabb about his campaign for Congress. He's one of several candidates running in next year's election to take over Representative Dwight Evans, who will retire at the end of his term.
But first, last week, Philadelphia City Council passed legislation that would ban mobile outreach groups that provide medical care and other services to people experiencing addiction in parts of Kensington. The neighborhood's open-air drug markets are among the most visible indicators of the city's opioid crisis. While advocates for mobile service providers say that meeting people where they are can help save lives, some neighbors say they encourage people in addiction to line up on the streets, making the neighborhood feel unsafe.
SEPTA workers are not going on strike. After months of negotiation and the threat of a strike if a deal was not reached, last week SEPTA and Transport Workers Union Local 234 announced a tentative agreement for a two-year contract. Reporting says that Shapiro's administration intervening was key to the deal. Workers will get a 3.5% raise each year for the next 2 years, and the contract would also increase contributions to pensions and offer better pay for night shift workers, among other things. A strike from SEPTA would have meant that all buses and trolleys, as well as the Market Frankfort line and the Broad Street line, would have halt operations. This would have affected over 750,000 daily riders, including over 50,000 students.
And last month, thousands of Starbucks workers across the country went on strike, and that included workers at five Starbucks locations in Philadelphia. Starbucks Workers United is demanding better pay, increased staffing, and more predictable scheduling. Despite some Starbucks workers unionizing 4 years ago, they have yet to win a contract. Workers hope that the increased pressure will force the company's hand. Many Philadelphia baristas joined a protest outside of the company's distribution center in York, PA last month. They point out record profits and pay for executives, with the new Starbucks CEO, Brian Nickel, making over $100 million in his first year. With only 5% of frontline Starbucks workers being unionized, the company says that the strike is largely not impacting sales.
Judges make decisions that impact all of our lives. But judicial elections don't usually generate a lot of attention from among voters in Pennsylvania. This year was different. Groups on the left and right of the political spectrum poured millions of dollars into the Pennsylvania Supreme Court retention election in hopes of influencing how the court rules on certain matters in years to come. But Pennsylvania is one of only a handful of states that even holds judicial elections. Around the Block reporter Casey Ruka brings us this story about efforts to remove politics from judicial selection.
Judicial elections usually fly under the radar for voters. But this year, there was unusually high voter turnout in Pennsylvania as millions of people cast their votes for or against retaining three justices on the state Supreme Court. Interest groups like Planned Parenthood and the ACLU spent millions of dollars on a campaign to keep these judges for another 10 years. And billionaire Jeff Yaw spent $2.7 million on efforts to get voters to say no. Retention elections are a way for voters to decide whether a sitting judge has been doing a good job or not, and whether they should retain their seat as a result. So why did an election, which wasn't even about pitting candidates against each other, gain so much attention? Dr. Richardson Dilworth is head of the politics department at Drexel University. He says one of the main reasons the race got so much attention this year is because the courts have become a battleground for major political issues like abortion and environmental protection. Activists on both sides of the political spectrum spent a lot of money and time campaigning because they felt they had a lot to win or lose depending on the outcome of that election.
When you have divided government, you're going to potentially have conflicts where a lot of those conflicts are going to end up in front of the Supreme Court. And so you're looking at the Supreme Court in terms of ultimately making sort of partisan decisions.
And it's not just about social issues like LGBTQ rights or access to abortion. It's also about how future elections are run. With many states engaged in partisan gerrymandering ahead of the 2026 election, it's often up to state courts to rule on whether these redistricting maps are legal.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has served as an important guardrail against partisan gerrymandering in the state. So this was an important election for Republicans and Democrats in terms of determining the fate of congressional districts.
Something about the importance of this election spoke to voters, too. In Philly, the percent of registered voters who voted in this off-year general election jumped to 34% compared to 22% in 2021. Philly, along with the rest of Pennsylvania, joined a nationwide blue wave this past election in what many are saying is a response to the first year of the Trump administration's second presidential term. But it also raises a few questions. When a lot of people don't know that much about the candidates, why do we vote for judges in the first place? Is there another way to select qualified judges? President and CEO of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, Debbie Gross, seems to think so.
The reason PMC supports judges being appointed through merit selection or through a process or a nominating committee is that, as we can see now, judicial elections are exceedingly expensive. Judges aren't politicians. They are supposed to be independent decision makers who now need to go out and raise money based on their party affiliation, which is just, the two just don't work together.
Debbie Gross believes that these politicized elections are decreasing the public's confidence in the judiciary.
People are viewing justices as political beings, as opposed to how they should be viewing them, as independent and fair decision makers.
About 34 states currently participate in some version of a merit selection system. The process of merit selection includes a nonpartisan committee coming together from a diverse set of backgrounds to evaluate judicial candidates and often submit their recommendations to either a state senate or the governor for confirmation. The thought is to have individuals that are educated about the courts and the judiciary make the recommendations for who should be selected as a judge outside of the influence of political campaigns. Currently, Pennsylvania is one of 8 states that only elects judges from the local courts to the state Supreme Court. For many years, there have been efforts to reform the courts to allow for merit selection, but none have made it very far. Some people argue that merit selection takes away the voice of the people, and others argue that just because the committees are supposed to be nonpartisan doesn't mean they always will be in practice. Professor Dilworth from Drexel sees potential issues with committees still being influenced by political motivations.
The question is, how far does partisanship reach? Are there safeguards in the nominating committee to make sure that it's bipartisan? When you have partisanship that runs as reasonably deeply as it does in the United States, especially over the last 25 years or so, it's pretty hard to remove that kind of partisanship from the judicial branch.
By themselves, retention elections, such as the ones we just had, presents a way to hold judges accountable. It gives voters the opportunity to evaluate whether a judge has been doing their job or not. For now, it doesn't seem like judicial elections are going anywhere. In 2027, Pennsylvania will have another Supreme Court election where 2 more seats will be up for retention and will show the direction the state judiciary is headed towards for the next decade. But it does seem increasingly clear that at least some judicial reform is necessary to temper the latest hyper-partisan approach to judicial elections. For Around the Block, this is Casey Ruka.
The 2026 general election is almost a year away, but the Pennsylvania primary is coming up in just 6 months. And that's when voters in Pennsylvania's 3rd congressional district will most likely pick the next person to represent them in the U.S. House. The 3rd district covers West Philly, Center City, South Philly, and parts of North Philly, and it has been represented by Congressman Dwight Evans since 2019. But Evans announced that he won't run for re-election next year, and around a dozen candidates have announced plans to run for the seat. Since Democrats outnumber Republicans by a wide margin in the district, the winner of the May 19th primary will almost certainly win the general election in November. Pennsylvania State House member Chris Rabb was one of the first people to enter the race. Rabb has represented parts of Northwest Philly and Harrisburg since 2017 and has built a reputation as a progressive candidate who won his first election without the backing of the Democratic Party. He joins us today to talk about his campaign for Congress. Representative Rabb, thanks for joining us on Around the Block.
Pleased to be here.
Just to be transparent, I've made a very small dollar donation to his campaign. And I'm also a member of the Sunrise Movement, a group of young people fighting for action to address the climate crisis. Sunrise Movement recently spoke with Rabb as part of their endorsement process. Representative Rabb, for listeners who may not know you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, why you're running for Congress, and what you believe sets you apart from other candidates in this race?
Sure. Thank you so much for the opportunity. So I'm Chris Rabb, better known by my 70,000 bosses in Northwest Philadelphia as Rep Rabb, and I'm in my fifth term in office, where I serve in the largest full-time state legislature in the country, about 100 miles west of Philadelphia. And I'm part of a new Democratic majority in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives going into our third year after 12 years of Republican domination. And our Senate, the state Senate, is controlled by Republicans. So we're one of the few state legislatures that is divided. In my time in office, I've been a progressive stalwart fighting for all things with the through line being justice, whether it's environmental justice, gender justice, reproductive justice, immigrant justice, racial justice, economic justice. All of these things are intertwined, and they're at the heart of why I believe we need more public servants and fewer politicians fighting the good fight and talking about the things that so few people in positions of power address, whether it's patriarchy or systemic racism, our addiction to fossil fuel, all of these things, talking and critiquing capitalism. All of these things are incredibly important, and there hasn't been a lot of people doing this work in elective office. And given the groundswell of young people and disaffected voters now, this is a great time to dig in and bring up these conversations about why this is so important, and also why we need to bring this fight to Washington, D.C. And so I'm seeking to take my track record and all the things that I've done in collaboration with others to Washington, D.C. to fight the good fight within a larger belly of a larger beast.
Rep Rabb, is there any legislation that you're particularly proud of that you've helped get passed in your time in the State House?
Oh, yes. A few things. But one of the prouder moments in my tenure in office was when I worked with now Congresswoman Summer Lee from Pittsburgh when she was with me in the State House. And she and I and others led a nonviolent direct action to shut down the House of Representatives for the first time since Ben Franklin was our Speaker of the House. And we shut it down because we listened to the voices closest to the pain who were protesting around the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor the summer of 2020. And we demanded immediate legislative action on police accountability. And within just a few weeks, we were able to get unanimous support for three Democratic bills that were enacted into law, one of which was a bill I authored some years prior that created a statewide police misconduct database so that killer cops couldn't sneak out from one police force and sneak into another police force without that community knowing about their misdeeds. So that's one example. Another one is fairly recent where I worked with a conservative Republican from across the state on a bill that would establish deed fraud as a part of the offense of theft. So you can get caught up for stealing a candy bar, but if you try to steal someone's home, there was a loophole that allowed professional scammers to get away with bilking vulnerable homeowners from their home while they're still in their home. And I was proud to work on that, which passed nearly unanimously out of the House of Representatives. So those are just two examples.
And moving away from local politics now and into more the national scope, as a representative in the U.S. House, you'll be, you know, playing a part in national issues. So what issues at the federal level are most urgent for you and why?
So actually, I just want to correct something. The work that I'm doing now is on the state level. And so The local level is like city council and mayor and so forth. There's this invisible thread of governance that happens on the state level that is very important and impacts things like the minimum wage or prisons and such. Those things impact 13 million Pennsylvanians, and it's very important piece of government that is in between local and federal. But to your point on the federal level, one of the things I'm very, very concerned about is how our country has been overtaken by the billionaire class. Whether it's media, whether it's our First Amendment rights, whether it's the climate crisis, whether it's living wage jobs for people, housing, universal health care, all of these issues are being thwarted by tech bros and what we call oligarchs, folks who control a great deal of political power because of their financial wealth and the influence of that financial wealth on our political systems. When we address that billionaire class and when we tax people who are the ultra wealthy, we have better ways of lifting up policies that can address all the other issues people care about. So there's nothing that you care about that is not impacted, almost certainly negatively, by how we have handed over our government and tax revenue to the wealthy. So I'm concerned about climate action. I'm concerned about reparations. I'm concerned about Palestine, ICE, and the dismantling of immigrant detention centers that should not even exist in the first place. All of these things were born out of corporate greed and pandering to the wealthiest members of our society. So tax policy, as boring as it may sound, is actually related to all the things we care about, whether we know it or not.
Thank you for that answer. And I want to dig into some of the stuff that you mentioned. Specifically, you talked about climate change being a big issue for you. With the Trump administration rolling back protections for our environment, what do you think Congress can do to tackle climate change?
Well, the Biden administration already started with the IRA. We're talking about subsidizing renewable energy, electrifying our grid, modernizing our our power grid. So right now, we don't have one grid. We have a patchwork of grids. The one Pennsylvania's in is called PJM. It is a ailing patchwork that if everyone were to switch to electric vehicles today, it would not be able to sustain the power needed to generate to run these vehicles. So we need to invest in infrastructure, and that's really, really important. What they're doing is divesting from renewable energies and trying to go towards fossil fuels, most notably fracked gas. And Pennsylvania is the second largest producer of fracked gas and the single largest net exporter of electricity in our nation. But fracking produces low-grade earthquakes. It produces methane at extraordinary levels. I've met people whose homes, whose lives, whose lands, whose water supplies have been devastated by fracking. We need to move away from fracking as soon as humanly possible and invest in clean and renewable energy and all the living wage jobs that come with it.
Right. And so another issue that you mentioned as being particularly important to you was Palestine. And so I wanted to ask, since October 2023, there has been an ongoing conflict between the State of Israel and militant organizations within the Gaza Strip, most notably Hamas. And the United States has since provided at least $21 billion in military support to Israel since the start of the conflict, according to Brown University. So if you were elected to Congress, would you vote in favor of military aid to the State of Israel?
I would not. And in fact, there's currently a piece of legislation right now called Block the Bombs Act. It's already been co-sponsored by 50 members of Congress that basically would stop the flow of weaponry, most notably the 2,000-pound bombs that have decimated Gaza and have killed over 70,000 civilians, many of whom are children. This legislation would also still allow for Israel's ability to defend itself through its Iron Dome defense system. But it basically lifts up international law and says that the U.S. has to abide by international law, which to me does not seem controversial. So that is my stance on that issue. But more importantly, we need to make sure that U.S. Removes its military approach to the Middle East and focus on diplomacy and making sure that we work with the international community to bring these to bring Israeli Jews and Palestinians together to decide what self-determination works, how that works, because they're the ones who should be at the table, not the United States of America. This is not annexed land for us to decide what happens. We should facilitate and use our considerable influence, not military influence, but use our influence to make sure that these stakeholders come to the table and work in good faith to figure out what's best for everyone in that land.
On the topic of diplomacy, we talked about Gaza. We also talked about the climate crisis, both of which are heavily contentious, and there are very different, you know, different approaches on, you know, either side of the aisle. And we often hear that that a divided government leads to gridlock. And this year's state budget delay was one example, and the recent government shutdown was another. So I wanted to know, are there ways that you've been able to find solutions working with people who don't share your values or your priorities, centrist Dems and Republicans? How do you work with those folks to get things done and pass legislation?
Well, virtually everything I've been able to get accomplished has been working with folks who don't share my politics. Just think about Thanksgiving gatherings when you're with a large extended family. That's your family. How much do you agree with, you know, your uncle, your cousins, whomever, right? So you're never going to be in lockstep with everything with someone you work with. And certainly in the political and governance perspective, that is the case. So most of the things I'm proudest of, I have had to work closely with folks who do not share my worldview. The example I gave before around deed fraud to make sure that vulnerable homeowners do not have their homes stolen from under them was with a very conservative Republican. Who on many issues, most issues, we do not see eye to eye. But the beauty of governance and people who are committed to true public service is that we find that common ground and we focus on that because we want to help people at the end of the day. I've done that with regard to another bill that was enacted into law. It was an amendment based on a bill I introduced years prior that basically would prohibit law enforcement officers from engaging in sexual activity while on duty, which you would think wouldn't need to be a law. Right. But what happened was there were predators in law enforcement who were sexually assaulting largely sex workers who were women and trans men. And when they got caught and they came in front of the court, they could have an affirmative defense where it was, oh, it was consensual. But if they're not allowed to do it in the first place, that prevents them from taking advantage of their position of power. And that was something I got through an amendment to a Republican bill on law enforcement, and that was working across the aisle. So pretty much everything I've done that I'm proudest of was working with folks who do not share my politics. But if you find that one thing or two things and you just focus on that, everything else becomes noise and you can focus on what can help people. And that same dynamic is what I will be coming into when I take office in January of 2027, whether Democrats are in the majority or not, is finding common cause with people and reaching people where they are.
Yeah. And, you know, we ask about, you know, how you can work across the aisle. But what something I think is interesting is we're in sort of a moment where it seems a lot of the Democratic Party's base kind of wants the opposite, right? And so what we've seen is sort of a very intense reaction that Democratic voters have had to the Trump administration. A lot of people think that he's sort of overstepped his authority. And so what I want to ask you is, you know, how do you think that Congress can check that executive power?
Well, you know, we have the ability to impeach. Bill Clinton was impeached. Donald Trump has been impeached twice. we have the ability to speak truth to power and call out and not normalize things he's doing and saying, things that some may consider war crimes, things that are considered illegal, offensive, unethical, and not say, well, you know, that's just what Trump does and it's okay. No, every single time calling it out and saying this is not right. And that also includes the policies and the staffing that he's put in place that further erode democratic principles and basic decency. He is the worst president in modern history, if not ever. He is a bigot. He is incompetent. He must be stopped. And more importantly, the ideology that is and the cult of Trumpism has to be addressed head on. And that has to happen in a bipartisan way, because there's two types of Republicans I work with, the ones who voted for Trump and the ones who love Trump. The ones who love Trump are the cult of Trump. They cannot be helped. Most of them will not be convinced, because it's not about ideology. It's not about facts. It's not about what's right or wrong. It's about doing whatever the heck he says. As for the other people who voted for Trump, they feel like they don't have good options. So we have to present better options. And presently, we're in a corporate duopoly where we just have Democrats and Republicans. And that corporate duopoly has lifted up two different camps. And one is corporatism and the other is oligarchy. And Democrats are more aligned with corporatism and Republicans are more aligned with oligarchy. And neither of them are good for this nation. And we need to have more choices, which, going back to what I said in the beginning, is why many young people and other folks, new voters, do not want to come out to vote, because they don't like a choice between a corporatist candidate and an oligarchy candidate. And so that's one of the reasons I'm running. I'm the only candidate who doesn't take corporate PAC money. I'm the only one who doesn't take AIPAC money. I'm the only one who is specifically and consistently talking about how it is our moral obligation to tax the ultra wealthy. And all of these issues are really relevant, particularly to young people, because most candidates who actually have a chance of winning are not going to say the things I'm saying consistently. And I think that's important in this moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we have a couple minutes left, but I want to ask, with the election being about half a year away, what's your campaign going to look like moving forward?
My campaign looks like what it's always looked like: diverse, young, grassroots, collaborative, and joyful, creative. It's not based on how many big checks I can get from insiders, how many endorsements I can get from politicians. It's about engaging young people, incorporating as many young people as possible, and fighting the good fight with authenticity and principled leadership.
Thank you so much to State Representative Chris Rabb for taking the time to speak with us today. The Pennsylvania primary election is May 19, 2026. Voters have until May 4th to register to vote in that election, and you can find out more by visiting vote.pa.gov. You can find a list of all the candidates for the 3rd Congressional District at ballotpedia.org.
Brad Linder is Radio News Managing Editor for WPPM. Peter Liu is Radio Operations Manager, and Allison Durham is WPPM's Radio Program Manager. I'm Crystal Herrera.
And I'm Sultan Smalley. And thanks to Allison Durham, who is our board operator for this episode.
Around the Block will be back next month with another episode featuring more stories and conversations from our team of Philadelphia area community journalists. And you can find more episodes of Block by Block on PhillyCam, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you find your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.